Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, welcome, everybody. This is Straight Up. This is part two. This is the private portion, which is for subscribers. So if you're listening to this, please know that Adam and I value so much your presence, your contribution, and your support in helping us continue to do the work we do. So thank you so much. And this one is really, I should tell you, I guess it's June 15th, 2019. And this two-parter, I had a different one in mind. I was going to be writing about being frugal, but all of a sudden events took over. We had the tanker attacks. I thought we needed to talk about that a little bit more. And as we continue into this weekend, I wrote these pieces principally on Wednesday and Thursday, with a lot of editing on Friday. But now Saturday, here June 15th, what we're finding is that there's a lot of what we would call prepping of the war space, right? So a lot of framing in the media, talking about how Iran, you know, is exiting the nuclear agreement, leaving aside sometimes entirely or placing it second the idea that the United States stepped away from the agreement first. And as well, the United States military is busy moving assets, big military assets all around Iran because they're worried about Iran's hostility. But of course, if Iran was busy moving a similar quantity of military assets off the coast of, I don't know, Long Island, I think we'd find the United States would have a consider that to be the aggressive move. At any rate, this one is called What Happens When War Meets Recession. We're currently on track to find out. I put a picture of up on this one, which is five black swans, because a black swan event, which we covered last time in part one, is this unpredictable, fairly catastrophic or a large impact event, which nobody sees coming. And I think that any sort of an outbreak of hostility that cuts off the flow of oil coming out of the Middle East is going to be not just one, but like a whole swan flock coming in and they're all black. So this is what I want to talk about today. And so now we turn to the recent tanker attacks in the Gulf of Oman and the looming recession indicators, which suggest some sort of a turn is at hand. Now, we've been tracking this recession for a while. I've got some new data in here. Now, these may well be connected, these two things, right? As the U.S. has a long and sordid history of pushing conflicts to distract voters from things like a slumping economy and to get them to rally behind incumbents, the whole tail wag the dog concept. The current crop of D.C. denizens seems more likely than others to conform to that particular sordid pattern. So let's turn to these tanker attacks. On the morning of Thursday, June 13th, 2019, we saw another two tankers, the first being the Japanese Kokura Courageous and the Norwegian Front Altair, were both attacked in the Gulf of Oman, just a few miles from the Strait of Hormuz. A very clear day, calm waters, high visibility, well after sunrise. So whatever happened, happened in plain view. The Front Altair was extensively damaged. I have a picture here which shows smoke billowing out, flames coming up off of it. And like the prior attacks that we saw last month, some sort of explosions ripped through the double hulls, this time alighting the cargo of naphtha or gasoline alight on the Front Altair. So it not only got punctured, but caught a fire. The other ship, the Kokura Courageous, had one hole, interestingly, above the waterline in what appears to be another unexploded device. Maybe, possibly, can't even be sure it's an actual explosive device, let alone who might have placed it there, if it is one, nearer to the front. And there's a picture here where two arrows and one set of arrow points to damage. It's labeled damage. The other arrow points to a little black dot on the side of the ship that's clearly standing out from the side of the normally smooth ship, and it's labeled likely mine. And the word likely is from the U.S. military, not me. And quite oddly, though, there's so many oddities about these things, which all conspire to make me think that we're being fed not entirely the truth, which is a very pleasant way of saying a false flag attack or that we're being lied to overtly as certain nefarious elements seek to get us into war. So quite oddly, we have this crystal clear image of the Kokura Courageous. It's from the waterline. It's from maybe 100 yards away, unless they were using a huge telephoto lens. But it's crystal clear. It's in color. It's awesome. And it still has that likely mine on the front of it. So whatever ship is here taking pictures is in the vicinity. So what's odd about that? Well, we have that crystal clear image taken from close range and at water level, indicating that a ship with a camera was nearby. Later that day, the U.S. government released an ultra grainy, super low resolution video that purports, and by the way, it's an infrared or FLIR, it looks like, that purports to show an Iranian naval vessel removing what was termed by the United States incriminating evidence. Well, first, we don't know what was removed. Second, we don't know who it might have incriminated if it was indeed evidence. A lot of things about it. Something else that's odd about this, I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's at least 11 dudes, maybe dudettes, but I'm going to guess dudes because the Iranian Navy, maybe, I guess. We don't actually know. I can't see any markings on the boat either. It's that grainy. But there's 11 people on the front of this ship all crowding near what's ever happening. So if it turns out this is an unexploded mine, it's a dud. Yeah, that's what I'd want to do. I'd want to put as many dudes on the boat as possible so that we could sidle up to and then put everybody on the front of the boat. I mean, let's just get everybody involved as close to this dud munition as possible, because we all know there's nothing safer than a dud munition, right? Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. Sometimes they blow up. I don't know. So I have a bunch of questions about this besides those. First, why is the video of such poor quality? So this would have happened first in broad daylight under a cloudless sky. So why infrared instead of color? Why weren't they using, normal video technology? And two, why didn't the ship taking the first image stick around and take some more nice high resolution color photos of whatever was going on there? And three, how can we be sure that the thing in question is a limpet mine, as described by the United States government, or B, placed there by Iranians, or C, even that the boat in question isn't a mocked-up Iranian naval asset being piloted by some other players, right? We could all think of a variety of likely suspects there, right? Well, the crew members of the Kokura had a very different story from that of an attached limpet mine, which just, gets a limpet mine is just magnetic. It parks, ship's made out of steel, you clunk it on there, and it's got a directed explosion and, makes a hole. So they had a different story, though, from that might accompany an attached limpet mine by reporting that, quote, flying objects, end quote, struck the ship. So this is from the crew themselves. And the point here is that with such conflicting reports, it's safe to say we don't really have a clear picture yet of what happened. Now, I wrote this on Thursday, Friday, now Saturday. I got to tell you, I'm scouring the news and I'm not getting any new information. Certain things are getting buried down the memory hole. I'm telling you, we're not hearing anything more from the crew members in this story who would be the direct people you'd want to quote. Like if you were a responsible news agency, you'd say, gosh, I think let's talk to the crew. They probably have the most firsthand direct information of what did or did not happen. I'm not being able to find any. They're buried at this point in time, as far as I know. Maybe so other people can find it, but I'm not finding direct firsthand stuff. I'm finding claims and assertions by the U.S. military, more specifically by Pompeo, Secretary of State, about what happened. But there are assertions, very little data to back them up, outside of that grainy video. Well, and there are some oddities about the timing of all this as well, and the reaction so far. To begin with, a Japanese ship was attacked on the precise day that Iran was holding a high-level meeting with the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. It was the first visit to Iran by any Japanese leader in over 40 years, and it's coming at a very delicate time. Japan was there to try and resurrect or in some way rescue the nuclear deal, allow Iran to, come back into the fold. It was a very delicate moment. And so a little odd, don't you think? that if it was Iran, they would have said, you know, this is a great day to attack a Japanese flagged ship with a cargo that's headed to Japan, right? So that was a little odd. And remember, it was just last week that a German foreign minister went to Iran to try and salvage the nuclear deal. So you've got Europe and you got Japan all trying to see if we can use diplomacy. And at that exact moment, we saw the attacks happen. So all in all, a very delicate, very unusual time for Iran to suddenly up and decide to target a couple more oil tankers, one from Japan and one from Europe, right? Not surprisingly, the U.S. immediately was able to pin the blame on Iran before any sort of analysis could have been conducted, and even though Iran denounced the action. So I'm going to quote here from an article, and it's Reuters, and the headline is U.S. Blames Iran for Tanker Attacks in Gulf of Oman. This is on June 13, 2019, and this is, quote, two oil tankers were attacked on Thursday and left adrift in the Gulf of Oman, driving up oil prices and stoking fears of a new confrontation between Iran and the United States, which blamed Tehran for the incident. Quote, quote, it's the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told reporters in a brief appearance without providing hard evidence to back up the U.S. stance. Quote, this assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, similar recent Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication, Pompeo said. All right, first, high degree of sophistication. Anybody who parks a limpet mine on the side of a ship above the waterline needs to be able to master magnets attraction to steel and explosives. Right? That's not a high degree of sophistication. So, and Mike knows that. Mr. Pompeo knows that. He's ex-CIA. Come on. And look, it's been my experience that when the government blame is immediate and prior to any possible inquiry to assess the data, then the blame was not only a foregone conclusion, but usually prepared well in advance and just waiting for an opportunity to be applied. As has become typical for U.S. officials of late, Pompeo made his claims without providing any evidence at all. It also bears noting that Pompeo is ex-CIA. That means he knows there are lots of ways to get things done. The final part in bold, where he asserts that only Iran had the motive and means, stands out for being really insultingly shallow, because literally any state agency in the world has the capability to pull off such an attack, as well as plenty of mercenary outfits, not least of which includes Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, the U.S. I could go on and on. It would be like a prosecutor standing in court asserting, Your Honor, and ladies and gentlemen of the jury, only the security guard in the bank had the means and the motive to enter the bank vault and remove those loose bags of cash, while leaving out the bank officers and tellers entirely from the equation. I mean, to do that, first you have to exclude the other potential actors, and that was something Pompeo either forgot to do, actually, of course we know he didn't forget, or felt it was unnecessary in the rush to judgment. So each of those state actors I just mentioned has plenty of motivation to pin something on Iran while mucking up the Japanese visit, and the U.S., and especially certain U.S. power players, have a very compelling list of reasons to try and pin something on Iran at this time. So here's the theory for you. The attacks happened in the early morning, but on a bright, clear day with plenty of visibility. The first attack was reported at 6.03 a.m., and sunrise there, where those ships were, was at 5.23 a.m. So this is 40 minutes after sunrise. So it wasn't a surface vessel firing a torpedo, or that would have been reported. I mean, it would have been seen and reported. Likewise, it wasn't a small boat pulling up alongside and placing a charge, because the ship's radar would have picked that up, right? If you've ever been on one of these ships, they've got this radar that's scanning the ocean, picks up all kinds of stuff, right? So very unlikely that we would have a surface ship sneaking up and putting that on the ships while they were in transit. So this leaves us with a submarine firing a torpedo or a limpet mine, which again is magnetically adhered to the hull at some earlier point in time. Like, maybe when the ships were at port? Because the damage we can see is above the waterline, I think we can exclude torpedoes, right? So probably some kind of a limpet mine or a missile, right? Well, the missile's a good idea, possibly, especially because of the, quote, flying objects, end quote, descriptions from the Kokura crew. Or maybe it was a limpet mine attached earlier. So here I'm showing an image which discloses where the ships left port. One left port from Al Jubail in Saudi Arabia, and another left port at Ruwais in the UAE. So a Saudi Arabian port and a UAE port. Now, how hard would it have been for Saudi, UAE, or Israeli, or US, or privately funded mercenaries from who knows where? How hard would it have been for operatives like those to have placed a magnetic limpet mine on the hulls of these two ships while they were at port for a later detonation? Well, that would range from slightly difficult, just slightly, to very easy, depending on whether the Saudi and or the UAE governments were in on the operation, right? It could have been Iranian agents too. The point is, it could have been anybody, but most easily those in the security services of the ports of call. So that's a theory, works perfectly well. I just put all of that out there simply to counteract Mike Pompeo's assertion that nobody but Iran had the sophistication and the opportunity to pull this off, or the motive, right? Lots of motives, lots of capable players, particularly in this region of the world. Now, remember, French divers bombed a Greenpeace ship in a New Zealand harbor, using a limpet mine, sinking that vessel back in the 80s and killing a photographer. Right? That was in 1985. It's probably even easier now to attach such a device using underwater drone technology, right? No divers necessary, less risk. So when Mike Pompeo says no proxy group in the area had the necessary resources and proficiency, he's simply framing the narrative away from the fact that the entire region is stuffed to the gills with state actors with an interest in stirring up trouble for Iran. While his statement isn't totally technically incorrect, proxy groups may not have had the sophistication, but let me call that into question too. Remember, the so-called proxy groups, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, also recently hit a Saudi airport with a drone or a cruise missile. So maybe they do have the sophistication. And that makes his statement very far from truthful and easy to pick apart. Painfully easy. Insultingly easy to pick apart. So whenever you hear something that's that easily picked apart, that of course nobody in the media picks apart, it tells you you're being gamed, right? You're being fed a load of something and it ain't truth. So where does it go from here? That's a good question. The tensions with Iran have been playing out for a long time. You know, I've written about this perennially at this point in time. I've written about the possibility of war with Iran during each of the presidencies of George W. Bush, Obama, and now Trump. Right, this perennial risk, it just flowers anew with great regularity. A recent piece by John Kemp, now he's the energy oil writer, analyst for Reuters. I really like his work a lot. He seems like a really thoughtful gentleman. I thought he captured the risks pretty well. He wrote, quote, the headline of his piece is Strait of Hormuz and the Risk of Uncontrolled Escalation. Some really good points in here. Quote, top U.S. policymakers appear convinced that they have achieved escalation dominance. That's in quotes, that word, escalation phrase, escalation dominance. I kind of like that one. Allowing them to dial up and dial down pressure on Iran at will and precisely without too much risk. In this scenario, Iran's best option is always to accept the degree of pressure applied by the United States, however unpleasant, rather than risk escalating even further. Right now, the United States is committed to keeping economic pressure in place while avoiding an outbreak of direct armed conflict. That means convincing allies to maintain sanctions while calculating that Iran will continue to abide by most of the provisions of the nuclear agreement and avoid military provocations, de-escalating the military confrontation while leaving the economic pressure campaign in place. But in such a tense environment, there is always the risk that a minor incident or accident will escalate in ways not planned by top policymakers. top leaders may not have full control over subordinates, proxies, and allies, and could find themselves pushed towards a conflict they insist they do not want. Iran may not have full control over the militias it has armed in Yemen. The United States may not have full control over hawkish elements in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel that want war with Iran. In the current state of high-tension, hawkish elements in both the U.S. administration and the Iranian government may exploit any incident to push their respective leaders to escalate. The vulnerability of tankers in the Strait of Hormuz is precisely the sort of incident that could spark an unplanned and uncontrolled escalation. Hormuz is not important because of the volume of oil that flows through the strait daily, but because it is an ultra-tense flashpoint that could spark a much broader conflict both sides insist they do not want. End quote. Short version here. Sometimes shit happens. Right? You ratchet up the tension enough, and some captain on some ship misinterprets a blip on the radar, fires a missile, sinks something, shoots something down, and game on. Right? That's kind of how these things can boil over. Now, Iran has been saying for a very long time they consider the sanctions to be completely unfair, and their point of view is this. They signed on to a nuclear non-proliferation agreement, and they were abiding by all of the provisions of that agreement. Now, that was signed under Obama. For whatever sets of reasons, Trump's administration decided they didn't like it. They convinced Trump that he didn't like it either, is how I interpret that. And the United States scuttled the deal. But not only do we walk away from an agreement that both sides had negotiated carefully and signed, Iran's busy getting inspected and opening facilities and being transparent as they need to be, as much as they need to be in order to abide by the treaty. So Iran does all of that. The United States says, nah, we don't like that deal. We want a better deal, but we're not going to ask for a better deal. What we're going to do is we're going to walk away from the old deal, and then we're going to crush your economy, Iran, and we're going to begin to poke at you militarily. We may even conduct a few false flags attacks and pin them on you, or whatever's going on. The United States is acting in very, very bad faith. Now, can have a lot of reasons why the United States feels like it needs to act in bad faith. Maybe it's a negotiating strategy, whatever it is, but the United States feels like it has what John Kemp termed, or the term that he pulled up called escalation dominance. Well, that's all fine and well until something happens that you didn't plan on, right? And then all bets are off. Now, listen, especially when you have these hawkish elements of the neocon, the Likud, the Wahhabist, the Persian varieties, who I'm sure exist too. There's those blue meme, hawkish elements who just, they're forced, right? These folks, they just don't take peace for an answer, right? They never back down. They only push forward and create more violence. And that's been true for a long time. It must be some quirk in the human genetic code. Don't know. The odds are that, you know, these just playing the odds. The odds are that nothing more happens from here, right? Oil seems to be signaling that right now, the price of oil. But if there's an outbreak from here, then it's my conclusion that the endless money printing, market jamming efforts of the central banks comes to a really very sudden and ignominious end. I'm in the camp that thinks Iran holds a lot of cards militarily. Other people disagree with that. And I think that because of the ease with which shore-based truck-mounted missiles can be hidden and rapidly deployed. Iran has a lot of coastline. It has a lot of anti-ship missiles with a range of well over 180 miles, while the strait's only 22 miles wide at its narrowest. So that leaves over 150 miles of interior landscape to scour for easily hidden mobile platforms, which is a nearly impossible military task. So again, the United States would have to park its carriers really far away out of missile range, which means it's, you know, whatever F-18 flights are going to do, or whatever drone flights are going to do, or whatever bombing runs are going to do to try and take out the Iranian military assets, they have to do that from pretty good distance, which means, you know, you have less flight time and there's less time to you know, patrol the air. And maybe Iran has S-300, maybe even S-400 missiles from Russia at this point in time. So it complicates everything. This is going to be a very different thing from taking on a country without any air defenses like Iraq. Right? Did you notice what happened when Syria got the S-300 systems installed by Russia? The game changed instantly. The United States was suddenly, and all the NATO allies were suddenly backed off. They had to stay above a certain deconfliction line, and the whole tenor and then even the direction of Syria's government forces being able to push back the ISIS rebels, everything changed. So Iran has that capability of protecting its airspace somewhat. I'm sure the United States would dominate. I'm sure the United States would mess up a lot of stuff pretty quickly militarily, but it's not going to be a cakewalk. There will be losses involved, right? And here's the point. It would only take one shore-based missile hitting one tanker to create just an enormous incident. So let's look at Recession Watch. Let's look at this is called Recession Watch Oil Edition. I need to go through the recession data because here's the idea. Things are kind of wobbly economically, globally. It wouldn't take much to set things tumbling down the stairs. So there are a huge number of warning signs that a recession is imminent, if not already here. And the price of oil is one of them. I'll talk about the others later. But right now, with oil inventories climbing, despite relatively low global oil output, especially from OPEC, oil is saying economic weakness is here. Now, right now, the crude oil in 2019 is in a bear market. It hit a high in April. It climbed through most of 2019, starting right there on January 1st. Oil climbed all the way up to a peak in April and has since gone into this bear market, which is defined as a decline of 20% or more. It's down 21% at the moment. And it didn't have that much of a pop. It had a pop, but not that much of a pop with the tankers being attacked there early in the morning, as far as I'm concerned, early in the morning of June 13th. So all we see is the tankers are attacked. Oil is literally skying and then it just stops and actually closed the day below that spike high. And below, oil didn't even close above the minus 4% route it experienced the day before on Wednesday. So that's saying a lot about the weakness in oil prices right now. Now, if you'd asked me 5 years ago what the impact would have been on the price of oil of a series of tanker attacks near the Strait of Hormuz, I would have easily said a huge price spike, $10, $20, maybe $30, not out of the question. But it went up just a couple of bucks before giving $1 back. No way, I'd have gotten that really very wrong. I don't know what the price of oil is saying here, but that profound weakness in the price of oil means, I guess, a couple things, right? It could mean that oil traders either don't believe that anything more serious will result from all the explosive activity near the Strait of Hormuz. I don't know if that's a good bet. Or they believe in the economic weakness story more than that, or some combination of both. Or the price of oil is just being manipulated by central banks. Who knows? I think the price of oil is too heavily discounting the geopolitical risk here. But after so many years of false bluffs by the United States, maybe the oil traders have got it right. You know, complacency. Maybe that's the right response here. Who knows? I do know I wouldn't want to be speculatively short oil here, personally. And this is a section titled Already Teetering. The reason I track the possibility of a recession so closely is because I don't think that the vast majority of people will be ready to discuss any of our many predicaments as long as everything seems fine, right? Despite a worsening trade war, despite weakening global trade, despite the many geopolitical risks, U.S. and other equity markets continue to rise and seem impervious to any and all bad news. The key mechanism for controlling that everything's fine narrative happens to be the financial markets, or air quotes time, markets, as they become. Prop stocks up long enough, the thinking goes, and that will hold everything together by keeping people suitably distracted. Well, so far, they're being very successful with this strategy, right? Golf claps for that. But if people are distracted by rising markets, how can we ever hope to have a reasonable conversation about disappearing insects or undertake the vast planning for the energy transition before us or attend to any of the numerous predicaments that we're facing? it's such a simple thing. It's almost like, you know, the markets are these shiny baubles that have, you know, transfixed the crow's attention. You know, it's like bird brain, right? Crows are smart. But I mean, the idea here is that as long as they can keep the stock market propped up, it keeps a lot of people lulled away from what's really happening and what the real risks are. And it's my view that these markets are no longer free and fair, that they've been taken over and used by various fiscal and monetary authorities. So that's politicians and Federal, you know, Reserve and other central bank authorities for a variety of purposes, ranging from crowd control via narrative shaping to keeping incumbents in power to simple, grubby private gain. In other words, the markets are now being operated as a government utility, right? And those of you following me on Twitter have seen me post a meme before. It's a famous one. There's a guy leaning back with a cup of coffee. He's on a college campus. He's got a microphone and another chair next to him. And there's always some sign in there that reads at the bottom, "Change my mind." And the text I put in above that reads, "U.S. equity markets are a government operated utility. Change my mind." Right? I've been posting that one on Twitter a long time. Nobody's even bothered to try and change my mind. Kind of weird. Perhaps the biggest sour note, however, in the ongoing stock bull parade is the dramatic inversion of the yield curve, which means what that means is that shorter maturity government paper is yielding more than longer maturity paper. So, for example, you can get a higher yield on 3-month paper right now than 5-year paper. So by paper, you know, I mean, treasury bills and bonds, right? So you get a higher yield on 3 months than 5 years. This is a key indicator. Whenever we see that, whenever we see an inversion like that with 3 months yielding on a higher percentage basis, more than 5-year paper, that key indicator has been inverted now for a full quarter, which is an historically accurate indicator of recession, or it has been in the past. I'll be the first to admit, interest rates are so heavily manipulated and deformed by so many years of central bank interventions that it's really, who knows what kind of a signal they're really sending or how much we can rely on it. I showed another chart, which is a difference between the 6-month and the 3-month T-bills. Again, we're seeing that 3 months are yielding more than 6-month paper. And again, outside of a recession, we've never seen a reading as low as it currently is. Right, that difference between the 3 and the 6 month paper, outside of a recession, never seen it before. And here's that data. So that's the sour note, right? And the sentiment of a recession is really starting to build as well among the corporate crowd. Here's a quote from MSN, quote, "Nearly half," so that's 48%, "nearly half of chief financial officers in the United States are predicting the American economy will be in recession by the middle of next year, according to the Duke University CFO Global Business Outlook survey released on Wednesday. And 69% of those executives are bracing for a recession by the end of 2020. Now, startling poll result right there, not because they see a recession coming. Guess what? Recessions happen and people see them. It's notable because of the high number and the high percentage, and because they're already, quote, bracing for a recession. Excuse me. Now, credit cycles, as opposed to business cycles, credit cycles, they have a bad habit of ending really very abruptly. While it takes a long time to slow down or even close a manufacturing plant or maybe fire a bunch of staff, the decision to stop leveraging the corporate balance sheet can be made this afternoon, right? It's a very quick, rapid decision. That's why credit cycles end so much more rapidly than a business cycle. And as I detailed in a recent Insider, the leveraging of corporate balance sheets now has been massive and ongoing since 2008. The leveraging of corporate balance sheets, fancy term for they borrowed money and they bought stock back. That creates leverage on the balance sheet. So that one feature alone, though, that was responsible for over $5 trillion of stock buybacks. We've never seen a period of stock buybacks like we've seen in the last, say, nearly a decade now. So bracing for a recession implies, at least, if anything else, a screeching halt to corporate share buybacks, right? So that's going to have a huge impact. Along with the cessation of borrowing to leverage the balance sheet, a recession also usually entails repairing the balance sheet, meaning undoing some of that borrowing and deleveraging the balance sheet, maybe buying equity back. In other words, the exact opposite of, selling more equity out. In other words, the exact opposite of the credit cycle dynamics that propelled everything higher and higher. Virtuous cycle on the way up, vicious cycle on the way down. Europe's already in recession. I have a chart here showing Euro area new export orders, the market PMIs, new export orders. Everybody's below the 50 line, which means everybody's in recession except for Spain, which had a surprising little ding there on that last reading. Pretty interesting that Spain would be the one leading the way there potentially. But otherwise, it's pretty much across the board with a contraction across all those new orders. And as well, the World Bank put out a big report sounding a very cautionary alarm about the recession risks and to them, the remote possibility of another financial crisis. That's not a remote possibility to me. It's a guaranteed thing that's going to accompany the next recession. Hat tip to Barbara there for that article link. And back in the U.S., heavy truck orders way down from last year. So these are Class 8 heavy trucks. Those are the things hauling the big semis down the road. It's interesting that the trucking industry is really highly cyclical. It's a boom bust tracker. It's very sensitive to conditions on the ground. Hauling rates rise and fall along with new truck orders on a very rapid basis, depending on whether there's too much or too little capacity. Right now, too much. So truck orders are way down. The brakes have been slammed on all those orders for trucks. And so that's you want a canary in a coal mine. Looking at the transportation indexes and looking at trucking in particular is pretty a good place to look. So thanks to Wolf Richter of wolfstreet.com for tracking that so carefully. And I had the chart that I have in here comes from him. Now, bubble timing, this is the tricky part. Given the nature of recent IPOs that we're seeing, those are initial public offerings, we're nowhere near the end of the bubble cycle for speculators. I can't call them investors anymore. You know, these are not investors. Not when they're valuing money-losing companies by the tens of billions of dollars each. Now, I don't think this bubble ends with mom-and-pop retail investors catching on and ducking out, right? It ends when the corporations pull in the reins. And unfortunately, a lot of speculators, I think, are going to go right over the saddle palm and onto the hard ground ahead. But for now, the speculators, they have the upper hand. Uber and Lyft, both just cash-burning machines, remain near their IPO prices when they really ought to be vastly lower based on fundamentals. Similarly, the most recent IPO of CrowdStrike, kind of a scary company with really unnerving ties to Google and the three-letter acronym agencies of the United States. Anyway, maybe we could value it based on its closeness to the empire. But at any rate, this is a company that lost $140 million last year. And it just had its opening day on IPO just last week, midweek. And it went bananas on the opening day. So a quote here from a financial article reads, "The security vendor's market value exceeded $12 billion on its first day of trading on the NASDAQ under the ticker symbol CRWD. That's almost four times the company's valuation in June of 2018 when it raised $200 million in its last private round, good enough for a $3 billion valuation. The California-based company traded at $63 a share, nearly double its IPO initial price of $34. Really? End quote. Really, folks, $12 billion for a company that was valued at $3 billion a year ago and was $6 billion just at the open? Look, that's crazy time, right? It's just there's no possible way to make sense of that. So the bubble's not dead yet. Tons of money out there, tons of fear of missing out, very greedy speculators who just want in on the next IPO. Very similar story also happened very recently for Beyond Meat, which is now valued by the markets at more than $6 billion, right? For a company that makes plant-based vegetable patties that taste pretty good. I've had some Beyond Burgers. They're really pretty good. But $6 billion? Okay, this is a company that loses a lot of money on tiny, albeit growing, sales and lots of emerging competition. So as I've said, look, tons of stories out there like this. The speculative fever is very much here and very far from gone. And I suspect that will all break down really rapidly at some point, probably after corporations lead the way and pull back on the borrowing and the leveraging. Fundamentals will matter again. They always do. And here I'm going to quote from Jesse Felder, who writes really nice pieces. Quote, "The chart below plots the Buffett yardstick against forward 10-year returns in the stock market. This chart may be the single best visual representation of one of my favorite Buffett quotes. The price you pay determines your rate of return." Right now, according to this measure, investors are paying such a high price that they are likely to receive essentially nothing in return over the coming decade, and that's including dividends. So this chart is showing the Buffett yardstick and the forward 10-year returns, a blue line and a red line. They are very coincident for decade after decade after decade, but of course they diverge wildly and enormously and by the largest amount by far, starting back in 2008. So thank you, central banks. Whee, more golf claps. Thank you so much for creating such deformed markets that none of our charts even provide a useful frame for the conversation anymore. So the above chart, listen, all this chart's really showing us it's just a terrible risk return setup. Perhaps by this chart, the worst in stock market history. And that really speaks to the degree to which I charge that the central banks have deformed, maybe even destroyed the stock market. Because after something like this blows up, who knows if anybody will ever buy stocks again. The chart shows that such deformations also can last a lot longer than most people, myself especially, thought they could. So the conclusion here, well, what if my conclusion that the endless money printing, market jamming efforts of the central banks come to a very sudden end? What if that's correct? Well, then what? First, as I've mentioned, credit cycles end suddenly. When they do end, that's nasty. Nasty times, full of unpleasant surprises. And this one promises to be even larger and more destructive than the prior two in 2000 and 2008. The everything bubble, look, it's going to die of old age at some point, but it's also in search of a pin, just like every bubble. If the Strait of Hormuz gets shut down and oil spikes in price, then that would almost certainly provide that pin. Or it could be something else. Perhaps a worsening of the trade war with China, which is already impacting U.S. ports and warehouses and trucking, all that, right? From my perspective, everything possible that can be done to hold the markets together is being done, including lying, cheating, stealing, right? The authorities fear a market downturn maybe more than I do, or at least as much as I do. They, too, know that once that ball gets rolling downhill, there will be no stopping it, and the damage... Well, the damage could be such that it takes many years, if not decades, or maybe never recover going forward. Could take literally forever. Maybe these are the good old days, right? So I fear that there will be no recovery. I fear that these are the good old days because, you know, we don't have decades of fossil fuel energy with which to play anymore. It may very well be that this is the high point of human comfort. In consumer ease, at least, right? Again, that standard of living and the quality of life we might experience. Now, those are two separate concepts. I think a lot of people, surprisingly, are actually going to enjoy more a future of less than they do this current abundance that we have. Because this abundance comes with, it's shallow, it's empty. You know, my personal story about this is that when I was getting my degree at Duke University, and we lived in a little town called Pittsboro, North Carolina, about 40 minutes outside of Raleigh-Durham area. And in 1989, a hurricane came through, Hurricane Hugo. And it was extra bad because it just for no other good reason, the weather had decided to dump 5 inches of rain on us the preceding week. So the ground is really soft. And even though we were about 3.5 hours driving from the coastline, Hugo had enough punch by the time he came all the way inland that there was plenty of high winds and a lot more rains. And so what happened was the trees fell with such density. It looked, our driveway looked like somebody, a giant had played pickup sticks. It was just all these trees laying on top of each other and interleaved and crossed. And of course, all the power lines came down. So guess what? It's a block party, right? You know, people come out and everybody's, you know, who normally aren't interacting all that much, suddenly we have to interact. There's no power. Our freezers are all melting. So everybody busted out the barbecues and, you know, you got to eat everything before it rots. And so it was a nice old party and we ate a lot of good food. And then a couple of weeks later, the power came back on and the blue glow came out of the living rooms and everybody wandered back inside. But if I went back there, people would still talk about those 2 weeks. They would say, that was a great time, wasn't it? Remember that? Yeah. You know, because that was an enforced moment of being able to be real again. I think that, and a lot of people say, oh, is that what you mean by a future of less? You know, I think it's a future of more for a lot of folks, but we'll see. So at any rate, it's going to be the high point, though, if I'm right, of human comfort, consumer ease. And maybe that future of living on less and doing less, needing and wanting less, I think that's a better future for a lot of people. At any rate, I suspect we're going to find out soon enough. The recession warning bells are ringing more loudly now than they were the last time I wrote about them. If we're lucky, there's still a year before one arrives. If we're less lucky, it's kind of already begun. And it's just not been noted in the official statistics yet. Remember, the NBER always backdates the recession, usually like they're 2 quarters late. Like, you're already 6 months into the recession. They're like, oh yeah, that thing started, you know, last October, right? That's kind of how they work. And all of that, though, presumes that there aren't any black swans in the way. So if there's some sort of a hostility outbreak that really suddenly price spikes oil, I think that that just gets the game moving earlier, faster, harder. So my advice, prepare yourselves as best you can. Many of your unprepared neighbors, your colleagues, family, friends, they're going to need your support in the coming future, of course. Be that financial, material, or emotional. Very few of them are going to have the appropriate context to know what just happened or why. They're going to blame themselves for losing their jobs or failing to have seen all of this coming. But of course, they were just living their lives and playing by the rules that had been set out for them in school and through their culture. And so they're really not to be blamed, but they will be experiencing quite a bit of pain regardless, I think. So with that, thank you so much for listening. We'll tune in next time for the next edition of Straight Up, which will probably be in a couple of weeks. And I hope you've enjoyed this. I've been enjoying taking the time and expounding and reading these pieces to you.